With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On today's Caped Wonder Superman podcast, we are traveling to France to talk one-on-one with one of our absolute favorites, a man that was there for so many of the most important scenes in Superman.
And his name is Peter McDonald, and he was the primary cameraman who worked directly with cinematographer Jeffrey Unsworth and director Richard Donner on Superman the movie and Superman 2.
Now, the Caped Wonder Superman podcast with Jay Towers and Jim Bowers on iHeartRadio.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Caped Wonder Superman podcast in Detroit. I'm Jay Towers, and as always, I'm joined by the founder of CapeWonder.com, Mr. Jim Bowers, who is just outside of Las Vegas. And Jim, I know we are connected to Zoom and ready to go, and I think Peter McDonald is ready for us. Peter.
Okay, I think we're hot to trot.
All right, we're ready. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. This is a real pleasure, Peter. So,
no, it's always nice. And I was very fond of everyone on, well, apart from producers on Superman. So,
Peter, can you just give us a little bit of the history before Superman? Because you worked for so long with Jeffrey Unsworth. Just talk about that relationship, how it got started, and really how you got into the movie business.
I was working down Fleet Street in London, which is, you know, the newspaper. I hated it. I was working for an Australian newspaper, and I were miserable assholes. Then there was an advert that Pearl and Dean, which are a advertising company, were opening a studio to concentrate on making commercials, because commercial TV was about to start in England. I think the secretary I was working with, she wrote a beautiful letter full of lies saying how much all I cared about was cameras and the film industry. Of course, all that was total bullshit. but I did learn very quickly. And I had the interview in Bond Street, London, which is a kind of posh street in London, with this very dapper man who ran Pearl and Dean called Byron Lloyd. I can remember his name. I can't remember where I parked the car, but I can remember his name. Anyway, for some reason, I impressed him. And the following week, I started as a clapper boy at the studio. I'd say I knew nothing about cameras. I screwed up totally the first week because I didn't even know, it's hard to believe, that film had to be loaded in the dark. And I didn't turn the light off the first time I loaded film into a magazine. They said to me, that was so quick, the way you loaded that, it broke all records. I said, it was so easy, you just look at it. They said, what do you mean, look? And I hadn't turned the light off, so 400 foot of colour film, which in those days was worth a fortune. But they were very kind. Jim Boddy was the guy in head of the camera department there. And for years and years after that, he and I used to bump into each other, mostly at Pinewood Studios. And each time I'd give him a hug and said, you realise, but for you, I'd have probably been sweeping the streets now or on the door at the studio, doing letting people in and out. So it's pure luck, which I think often things are. And then, of course, the next bit of luck was Jeffrey Unsworth, who was just becoming famous. Rank was just closing down. So all the people like himself that were employed at Rank were going freelance. I mean, it's like a perfect storm for me. I got on well with him. I was a clapper boy. Johnny Alcott was the focus bullet and then became a very famous cameraman himself. A lovely operator called Jackie Atchler. So it was great. I mean, the first film was really awful because we ended up in Tahiti in Bora Bora. So you imagine I'm an 18-year-old kid taken to Bora Bora, hello, I'm being paid. Not a lot, but I'm being paid. So that was my beginning. I don't think it ever got better than that, to be quite honest.
Amazing. Now, was the first film that you and Jeffrey worked on together A Night to Remember?
Correct, yes. I came in just doing extra work. You know, they had this huge Titanic at quite a steep angle built on the back lot, and it was freezing cold. And I got a call from Pinewood. I didn't have a car, very few of us did. And it was like, I think, two buses and a train and a coach to get there. Because I just arrived in a little jacket and it was freezing. You know, everyone else was, you could hardly see that there's so much clothes on. To keep warm, I ran everywhere. When we needed a lens, I ran. When I needed, by pure chance, it worked for me because a few months later, Jeff and Johnny Alcott were looking for a crew to make this film called Tamaheen, which is one that went to Tahiti. And Jeff, what about that nice young man that ran everywhere? You know, they checked with the studio and they found out my name. And that's it. I never looked back. I worked with Jeffrey. After 2001, John stayed with Kubrick and I took over John's position. And then Jeff knew how much I'd wanted to operate. I hated being a camera assistant. I wasn't at all technical. I hated every second of it, to be quite honest. Looking through a camera, I felt totally confident. I'd only just become a camera assistant, and now I'm going to be operating on really fairly substantial films. But it's amazing because I'm quite a nervous person, but I never ever felt nervous when I had a camera in my hand. I just felt, you know, that was what I was here for. I loved that every second of it. And I still do. I mean, I can hardly lift them up now. I'm so old, but I still enjoy that part of filming. You know.
Well, the camera is an extension of you.
Oh, yes, it very much so. I mean, for a lot of people, it wasn't. You know, a lot of people, camera was there as a kind of big technical. I mean, because they were huge in those days. So, but I always felt that was me. That was my eyes. I felt very much a part of it, you know. And then when cameras got smaller, because I'm not a very big person, but I could really do interesting handheld stuff because in those days I was very agile and it came natural. So I didn't have to think. I could almost watch a rehearsal and go to exactly the spot that is the best place to film from, you know, but I didn't have to think about it, which I was quite lucky because, you know, I've worked with people and they spend half an hour, 3/4 hour, oh, where should we put the camera? For me, it just seemed, watch the scene, that's where it should be. And when, you know, the actor moves there, we'll track across and da-da-da. So that all came second nature to me, which, you know, thank God it did because it set me up with Jeff. And Jeff was a very, very quiet man. I mean, really quiet. I mean, when he asked me about would I go operate, and I said, no, I'm not really ready for that, Jeff. And I said, on top of that, I feel, because you won't have confidence in me, even you know me as a camera assistant for a few months, you know. Well, the director and I, a man called Joe McGrath, we will promise you, we won't look through the camera, we won't bug you, and you do it. Of course, that was even worse. Now I'm totally, I'm totally in charge. And it was great. I mean, it was a film with lovely Shirley MacLaine, who was a delight at the time, was one of the top actresses in the world. So that was really good fun.
If you think back just on the initial conversation you remember when you knew we're going to go do Superman, which hadn't been done as a major motion picture.
No. Well, I was incredibly excited, you know. It was really an all-star crew. You know, I was the only one. It wasn't a star, to be quite honest. The cameraman, the art director, they're all names, the editor, and of course Dick Donner, who was a force of nature. You know, Dick is, he really let me have my head, you know, and let me go and gave me a hard time in his own way. I mean, we see it rushes the following day after saying it's a complicated shot. And the shot had come up and he said, oh, just a second, everyone. This shot was Peter's idea. I've no idea if it's going to be a total fuck up or not, he said, but you know, I had to let you, he said, like, you know how he sulks if he doesn't get his way. So I let him do the shot. And because I'm getting smaller and smaller, I'm sitting in this Pinewood theater, you know, with, I mean, a lot of people there, you know, because you know, it's a huge film. And Dick making his little speech, never nasty. It was always kind of just, I was a kid, you know, we gave the kid a break, you know, let's hope he doesn't fuck up too much type of thing. So I've thanked, you know, Dick several times, but you can't thank Dick, you know, he doesn't take praise or, but he was very, very kind to me and very trusting. And I didn't let him down. I mean, I fought hard for everything, you know, I wouldn't, you know, sometimes you know, Gene Hackman, who I really like, I did 3 films with him, but he could be a bit, a piece of work sometimes, you know, and you had to stand up to him sometimes, you know, but we had a very good relationship. Chris was very, obviously it's his big break. He's nervous as anything. He's worried about what he looks like, whether he can carry it off or not, you know. And we went to New York to shoot and we're in the theater land. And it was like 11 o'clock at night. And I'm up on the camera crane with Chris on the window. So I think he'd done the shot, but he's climbing up or he just caught the burglar. I can't remember exactly. And the theater crowds came out. They'd been seeing an Ibsen play or something, you know, high class play. And these are New Yorkers. And they looked up and they all started, my God, it's Superman. Come to save it. And they did all the dialogue that kids do. And these were like, people had just seen a really heavy duty play. And I looked at Chris and I said, you're home and dry now, aren't you? I said, if this crowd think you're Superman, then let's just try and see if you can fly. I said, maybe you'd even try. He said, I don't think I'm quite that stupid. But I think that was when he realized that it was going to be what it was, you know, a a life-changing experience for him, and a film that I think most people who worked on the film are very proud of,
Well, the whole verisimilitude that Richard Donner impressed upon everybody, that everybody believed that this guy could be real and that he really flew. And I know Chris talked about the actor who played the burglar.
Yeah.
He was scared to be on the wires, and he said, "Don't worry, I've got you."
Yeah.
So there was that total confidence and belief all the way through. And I know from talking to Chris how serious and committed he was to the parts, both parts. And he called himself a very gung-ho person when it came to pulling off those characters for this film.
Yeah. At the beginning, obviously, he was a bit unsure. And also, his body wasn't anything like, I think we did the first test, and then he had 5 or 6 weeks when the stunt guys brought in a physical guy, and they really built him up, hugely in a few weeks. I didn't think it'd be possible. So he started, bulging where he should be bulging. I thought it took a lot of courage. If Superman didn't work, he's finished, because it'd always be put down to him. He is a good actor, and I think that comes off very well,
What about filming the Krypton scenes? Because, you knew Brando was coming, and it was really revolutionary the way, and you're looking at it behind me, but how these scenes were filmed.
Yeah, Jeff and Dick went on a recce to Canada and left me in England with the thing that they're going to wear this, like you see behind, a reflective costume. And so to make that work, the light has to come directly from the center of the lens onto the costume. So I made up a light box go in front of the camera with a light in it, looking directly at this 60-40 mirror, get it dead center, so it's right in the center lens. And this light was not a huge, powerful light, but it went straight into the 3M material. And then we had that on a dimmer, so Jeff Unsworth could just take it down to where he thought was acceptable. And Jeff was very daring. I think a lot of cameramen would have played it a little bit safe, but Jeff always went for it. He's a very brave, a very good cameraman, a brilliant cameraman, but also he had a lot of courage, which...
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And I noticed later on in Superman, while other different cameramen were doing other units, you had to keep an eye on them because they had the same, or exactly the same as equipment, because I had about 6 or 7 of these light boxes made. If a new cameraman came in, I know they hated me, but I used to go and make sure that they were brave enough to tweak the light. So when you looked at a camera, it was bleeding. But if it didn't, it had no magic, So it was really a matter of keeping an eye on everyone and making sure. Because the other thing when you have several units is everything, it's difficult to make everything match. You know, could the first unit doing one look and the second unit being not so brave. And I say Jeff was he's a proper English gentleman, very polite. So I used to get annoyed sometimes. I said, "Go and tell them, Jeff." So I used to go on the stage and say to Jeff, I told Jeff's a bit busy, but we just saw the rushes, and you need to, Jeff feels very strong. You need to tweak up that light box a little bit more, And I said, Jeff, it's no good if ours looks this way and the other units are not nearly as daring, Jeff takes responsibility, and took a little bit of time, but then they all got daring. Then you had to watch them in case it went over the top, because you go from one extreme to the other. Because if you went too strong on the light box, someone like Brando could almost disappear, because the reflection from the 3M material would bleed onto his face, So
today you can correct things digitally. You could not then.
No. What you shot was what you had.
Yeah.
And I say, as it was done in camera, no, there's nothing you could do about it. Overall, you could bring everything down or take it up, but it's really having the courage and the expertise to do it, breaking new ground. And I thought it really worked extremely well. I must say, I was very happy and very proud of what we did.
Now, am I correct when I say that only looking through the lens could you tell how bright the light was on the costume? So people standing around you didn't see that reflection. Is that right?
Yes, the light had to go straight down the center of the lens. Only the camera gave you the actual. And of course, in those days, the camera wasn't a reflex. The camera was a with a viewfinder on the side. So you'd line up looking through the camera, but then you had to rack the camera over before you shot, so the film went where the eyepiece was. It like in no man's land a little bit, you know. We got it down to, I think, quite a fine art, you know. And of course, the producers paid an absolute fortune for Brando. the more we wiped him off the screen, the more we're just paying this guy $3 million, and we could hardly see him. You know, so you can hear him, can't you? So, and Brando was good as gold. He was a lovely man. I mean, he really was.
Did Brando take interest in what you guys were doing? Because I don't know how many films he did that had kind of technology like this in a different way of doing it. I mean, here's this box on the front of the camera, and I would think an actor, he's going like, hey, what is this?
Well, first, he's a very, very intelligent man. I mean, he'd come on every day ready to shoot. You never waited for him, you know. He would bring all the English newspapers, the Times, the Telegraph, Financial Times. He'd bring those with him, piled next to his seat, and then he'd just sit there reading the day's news until we were ready. And I say totally professional, and also nice humour, you know, because we had a somewhat hard time from the producers about, well, none of us got good money, and also the hours became a bit stupid. And I remember Brando saying to me, "You look a bit tired." I said, "Well, we were here till 11 o'clock last night." He said, "You need a shop steward." I said, "Would you do it?" He said, "I can do it, yes." So he said, "I can certainly sort out that lot." I think the soul cars were a little bit panicked because it was obvious to everyone that he really got on well with the crew. You know, we had a great respect. David Tomlin, who was a first assistant, without a doubt, was the best first in the world at that time. Jeff Hunt was a superb cameraman. And I wasn't too bad at what I did. So very professional. Dick loved humor, you know, so it was always kind of a slight lightness in everything, you know. So,
well, he was always laughing. I loved his laugh. You could hear it. It seemed like a mile away. So you probably heard it throughout the sound stages.
Oh, yes. No, it rattled, you know. He would sometimes play a game with me and Jesus, there's a shot now that Peter talked me into. I didn't really want to do this. So let's think about if we have to retake it, you know. I mean, he did it every time. He convinced me that I might have screwed up and, you know, we didn't. You know, Jeff obviously went along with what Dick wanted and took huge chances. I mean, Dick called us in the office, Jeff and I in the office after a few weeks at Pinewood, and said, "You know, I'm a bit worried they might want to replace me with Dick Lester." So I said, "Well, I've worked with Dick Lester, and I said he's the most charming man, but would never take on all this technical stuff." So it all worked. It's a tough film to do. You know, everyone knows Superman, though, so he must have had some sleepless nights. We all did, but he must have more sleepless nights than us, because I try to assure Dick Donner that Dick won't take over this one. He might take over later on when the twos and threes are made, but this one is not at all his bag, because we have to work out all the problems now. And even the flying was, because, you know, people hadn't really done the flying rigs. We had at one time four flying rigs on the big stage at Shepperton. Then I had my own flying rig alongside them, so I could track along the whole length of the stage, especially when the three heavies came in. And it took a lot of working out, a lot of organising. And what I did eventually, each flyer had their own little team of two, maybe three people pulling the cable around the background. I'd have it marked on the floor where one person overtook the other, so they couldn't see anything. But they just looked at the floor and they knew at this point you've got to overtake Jack O'Halloran or whoever it is, or the camera's got to go a bit faster. So once we worked that out, it was quite, I wouldn't say simple, but it was technically possible to do it. And also, I think, do it very well, you know.
What about the challenges of when you're making a movie and then you have miniatures? So you had this live action, large scale set for Krypton, but then you had miniatures in Krypton as well, and that has to look like the big stuff.
Yeah, we had our own model unit who were very experienced with Paul Wilson, Derek Meddins. They'd done a lot of this, you know. The wide shots of models and our shots, it's all got to have that same look, and they were a bit reluctant to use the kind of filters we used, but obviously they had no choice because it has to match, you know. And I think it worked very well. I mean, I haven't seen it for quite a time, but I remember when we had the premiere at the Odeon Marble Arch, which at the time was the biggest screen in Europe, all the crew were asked to bring their family and friends, you know. So there's about 1,500, 2,000 people. It's a full theatre, you know. It's the first time my son had been to the cinema. I think he was like 5 or 6 years old. I didn't know if he's going to last 3 hours, you know. And of course, when the end credit comes up, the kids are screaming, no, no, they want to turn it back on again, because they were into it, you know, because we thought maybe 3 hours, they're all going to get a bit. And all the kids were shouting out, especially the girls, you know, when Margot Kidder was saying, don't worry, Superman will be here soon. He'll look after you. He'll get you out of the car. They were giving advice to the screen, which I thought was quite sweet. And it's all these things that I think Dick understood exactly what the American, especially the American audience would want, you know.
Well, here you are in Shepperton and Pinewood, and then you go to the hustle and bustle of New York City, and then to the beautiful Canada. Jeff and Phyllis and Glenn, just amazing cinematography there. Talk about that a little bit.
The exterior is like the wheat, but it was in Calgary. And we planted like 6 months earlier, they planted a whole field of wheat for us. No one was allowed to touch it. When he leaves home, he's there in the field with his mother. I went back early, because lunchtime, I went back early, got the big Chapman crane with an extension and rehearsed with my grips, who were friends of mine forever, this really sweeping shot through the wheat and then just going above the mother's head into the space. And then told Dick, I said, come and look at this, you know. I said, oh, what you done, kid? So I said, this is that. I said, what do you think? He said, what do you think I think? I said, well, just, he said, it's f-ing great. Well, don't talk about it. Let's do it, you know.
The one thing you have there that you're not dealing with on a soundstage is you're dealing with weather. And wasn't there quite a bit of rain? I mean, you really have to wait for a great shot on when you're filming like that.
It wasn't too bad. You know, it's always, I swear the cameraman, you know, the photographer, you know, has to be quite strong, you know, because he's waiting for the matching light. And the producers just think, you know, this is costing X amount of $100,000 a day. Fuck the light, let's just shoot, you know. So I think everything we shot really matched, and it had to match, you know.
One of my favorite shots that Jay and I talked about going back to Pinewood is that nearly 3 minute continuous shot from Perry White's office all the way to Clark Kent clicking the button for the elevator during the helicopter scene. That I point that out to people that, watch it again. There's not a single cut in the segment.
It wasn't a Steadicam. It was on a thing called an Elimac. And I had the floor of the office made. We could track anywhere. We don't have to lay balls. The boards that were laid for the set, we could track on. I had Frankie, my gripper, I said, I had forever, you know, and I knew if anyone could do the shot, Frankie could as the camera grip. Yeah, we just rehearsed and then with the doubles, and I showed Dick what could we do. And then we brought on Margot Kidder, who I say is totally blind. So we're doing the first rehearsal and we're tracking down the corridor. And next thing I know, she's walked by the camera. She's at the back of the camera and stood in front of it. And Dick got quite angry with her. And I said, I mean, Margot is, without her lenses, she's barely blind. You know, just try and any kind of corner your eyes see if you're in front of the camera so much better than being behind it, Margot. I said, oh, yes, I realise that. I'm so sorry. I said, no, you don't be sorry. You know, 'cause she's also thinking about performance and all that type. She was an adorable person, really. I mean, a bit scatty, but that's perfect for the part, you know.
Yeah. How many times do you think you shot that scene?
Oh, I wouldn't think not more than 6 or 7 times, you know, because I've always found if things don't work quite quickly, the whole energy goes, you know, the actors can't, everyone changes. You know, it's always the first 2 or 3 takes that seem to have the energy and the vitality that you need.
I love the way Chris catches his coat in the ladies' room door so beautifully.
Yeah, yeah.
And then runs to the elevator like Clark Kent, as opposed to running like Superman.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered who the guy was in the elevator. We only see his arm. He's going up, up, up.
I can't remember, but that was one of the more difficult shots we did. But it was, I say, everyone was very, very professional. And actors, like, they also help you a little bit. You know, I mean, some actors...
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We'll just walk straight past the camera if you're not tracking quick enough. But good actors know that sometimes, I'm not a lot, but I have to help you a little sometimes, you know, just by maybe just slowing down a touch. And
you know, Peter, one of the things that that fans of this movie, lifelong fans of this movie, will do when traveling is they try to visit different locations where the film was shot. And one of the things, we've all done it, and you'll see them on the internet, but people will go to the New York Daily News building, whether it's open or closed. The lobby's always open, but everyone wants to get a picture of that globe and walk that walk. Do you remember much of that day? Because I mean, that again, now you're dealing with an actual working building with elevator people, and that's a great shot.
Yeah, we talked it through a bit, rehearsed it, and we just shot it. You know, and I think I can't remember, certainly didn't shoot it a lot of, didn't have many takes. You know, because I say I had a really good crew. You know, you're shooting on the streets of New York. You don't get a lot of time and a lot of leeway. You know, you have to get it right, you know.
Was there ever any discussion about going back and refilming or any of the early stuff, for instance, in the Fortress of Solitude? Is there ever any discussion about that? Because I know that's when Chris was just getting into his part and learning what it was all about. And they were filming Superman 2 scenes before they were filming Superman the movie scene.
At the time, we were going to make both together, you know, and then that didn't work out, and we just concentrate on one. But I did say to the producers, you know, you realize we have shot more of two than we have of one at the moment, you know, because they weren't really tuned in, because it wasn't the greatest chemistry between the Solkinds and Donna, you know. There wasn't they never really, I mean, in my opinion, never really supported him as much as they should. I never once saw him lose his temper or try to blame anyone if something went wrong. You know, he was always there. And, you know, he had sometimes a bit of a rough ride with Gene Hackman, can be a bit of a terror. I did, say, three films with Gene, and he could be a bit of a handful. And, of course, then you had lovely Ned Beatty, who was such a wonderful, delightful, funny guy. And if anything got a bit tense, he could always come up with some line and everyone would start laughing. So, you know, that was all perfect. And I say Brando was very... Everyone was very nervous about working with him, but he was actually, I thought, tremendous, you know. And he did have all these boards all over the place with his lines on it, you know. We also had a prompter on the camera, and he was having a bit of trouble with the lines. And he said to my camera assistant, "Do you have that one, a black plastic pencil, Chinagraph?" So John said, "Well, yes." He said, "Can I borrow it?" So he borrowed it. So then he starts writing some of the words on her forehead. I've never seen the expression on her face, because she was a lovely lady. She's just standing still with him writing the key words on her forehead, which obviously we couldn't see because we were behind her. You know? But I think there's just things like that are kind of delightful moments, you know.
I think one of my favorite parts of David Michael Petrou's making of Superman the movie novel is when he quoted you, and he said there's only two people who could have directed Superman, and both of them are Dick Donner.
Yeah, I don't know what I meant, but I thought it sounded quite clever at the time. It was slightly humorous, and maybe a bit of truth in there as well somewhere.
Oh, it's a fantastic book, and David has been on our podcast, and he's also a great friend of ours, and has shared so many great stories from behind the scenes, because he got access to everywhere.
He did, yes. You know, he got a huge amount. I think that the producers, you know, gave him kind of free hand, you know. Once people knew they could trust David, because you know, at first people were a bit wary.
Yeah.
You know, cause he looked like he was a plant, you know, the producers kind of tell tales on us. But instead of that, he was a delightful young man, you know, and I say, and he became part of the crew, you know, and very often on a Friday night, he and several of my camera crew, sometimes me, not very often, would go out and have a nice meal in Notting Hill, where his hotel was, you know. So he's a good man. He was a good man.
Well, he talked about the July 13th, 1977 New York blackout, how they had to go up the stairs with candles up to the Mayflower Hotel. And
It was we were shooting. I can't remember exactly what location in New York was, but I had a high camera looking right down New York, you know. Suddenly, I was looking through the camera, and the light started in the far distance just to go out, block after block after block after block. Jeff and that electric, they plugged a lot of our lights into the system, you know, the New York lighting system. We thought, oh, shit, we've actually done this, but I think it was something bigger than that. And then we couldn't shoot. What was quite lovely was, as you drove to, you know, the corners where the huge amount of traffic would have been, normal citizens were out there guiding traffic through. So everything was moving, not as quickly as it would be normally, because no traffic lights were working. You know, the New Yorkers were out And then we got to the hotel, mostly walking to the hotel, and started climbing the stairs. And you could hear moaning and groaning because a lot of people were locked in the elevator. You know, they've been in the elevator for hours sometimes. You know, and then I think the following day, I think it all came back quite quickly, and it wasn't us that had blown the fuses. It was I think there'd been a big storm near the main power.
And right. it was also hot. I mean, it was a heat wave as well. I mean, to deal with heat like that and then not have power.
Oh yeah, they said it's always the same in the film industry. It was the hottest summer they'd ever had, or 400. It's always that way. It's either, you know, the most rain, we've never seen rain before, or it's the hottest summer, and it was hot. With Chris, you had to be careful because, you know, the sweat would come under his arm, you know. And when we did the first test, you know, there was quite a bit of sweat around, and they got a doctor in and said, what can we do about this, you know, the sweat glands? And the doctor said, he's quite a nice English guy, very dry sense of humor. He said, oh, he said, I can cut those sweat glands out from under his arm. And the producer said, really? Oh, yeah, he said. But of course, he said, you understand one thing, it will come from somewhere else. Out. And I think at the time, Chris would have probably done it, you know, because he needed the work. So it was, never did that. And they just got used to keeping them as cool as possible.
I've got some movie posters framed in my media room.
Yeah.
And I just realized that the three of them I'm looking at right now, you were involved in all three of them. The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Superman, your career is absolutely incredible. And I was reading about your Hoth planet visits.
That was fun.
Norway.
Yeah.
Just fan films that you've been involved with.
Yeah,
just...
that was fun. The trip to Norway was really great fun to do because when we shot there, it's 40 below. It's very, very tough. And then we went there at this celebration, and we were invited. They still talk about it as if it was yesterday. For a lot of them, it was the kind of biggest event of their lives, you know. And it was a real privilege to be there with them, you know.
What are your thoughts today about just, you know, many of these great films that we love, including Superman? They do the 4K transfer now, or Blu-ray. I mean, you've seen...
Yeah.
Kind of these new scans as somebody that was there and really saw the pure look of that film, you know, in a theater. What are your thoughts of some of the new technology they're using to restore these films?
Oh, I think it's great that you can do that. You know, I mean, the Superman looked fantastic when we first shot it. You know, I think whatever you can do to keep it looking as good or even maybe better, that negative's getting a bit old, a bit like all of us. So it's anything you do to make it still stand out, you know. Jeffrey Unser died, and I while he was on tests with Polanski, and then I ended up grading the film, you know, because I knew Jeff forever, and I knew how daring he would have been in the laboratory, you know, making it the way he wanted it to look, you know. And I got quite a bit of a stick from other people because they wanted to play it a little safe, and I thought, you know, I kept on looking up in the sky. I thought, well, if Jeff's watching this, he's relying on me now, and I'm not going to let him down. And I don't think we did. I think the film had a great look, and still very proud of it.
I was reading American Cinematographer magazine, the January 1979 issue, and there's a fantastic feature on Superman, including an extensive interview that you did right after Jeffrey passed away.
Yeah.
And you talked about how nervous you were to be going in to grade the film or to color time the film, as Americans call it.
Oh, yes. Oh, I was, you know, because I'd never done it before. So I'm doing the biggest film ever made at the time, I guess, with people thinking, who's this cocky arsehole? What does he know about things, you know? And all I'm thinking about, because I sat with Jeff a lot of times when he was grading, I saw rushes with him every single day. So I knew what his wish would be. And I knew I had to fight his corner, you know. And the film eventually, I feel, is exactly as he would have liked it, you know, because Jeff had a tremendous courage about photography. You know, he never played it safe. And Jeff would say, look, it's my responsibility. This is what I want you to do. And if it doesn't work, then I will take the can, but not you, you know. So,
well, you call him an impressionist.
Yeah, I just think if you see like tests, and he's done some beautiful work on Beckett, which we did with Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton. I mean, the scenes in the cathedral on Beckett are, some of the best photograph scenes ever, you know, because although it was a set, you totally believe you're in this huge cathedral. You know, it's a marvelous production designer, John Bryant, who is also the producer. So he was in a great position because he could spend whatever he wanted on the sets and make them fantastic. And no one could tell him off because he was also the producer as well. So, and Jeff and he went back forever. You know, they went back years and years and years. So there's a great, great respect between them, which is lovely, you know.
When you're doing a movie, you don't often get to hear what the movie's going to sound like other than the dialogue you're watching. And I'm curious to know your impression of hearing what John Williams did for the first time.
Oh, I thought it was unbelievable. And I was lucky enough to be involved later with John Williams in some of the recording of the music, you know. And he was a very humble man, I thought, you know. But I thought the music was tremendous. The first time I heard it, I thought, oh, is this right for the kind of superhero? Then you realise it's not going to go over the top with great big drum things, all that. I just thought he had it exactly right, you know, and the romantic scenes. And it just, and I say, had a really lovely, lovely man, you know, very nice indeed.
Well, that's certainly one of the favourite soundtracks among movie fans alongside Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, Close Encounters. Yep. And I remember Dick Donner talking about how excited he was when he heard it. And I think Chris Reeve sat in on most of the recording.
I can believe that, yes, because Chris was a very sincere young man. I mean, if it hadn't worked, I mean, you'd never hear of him again, you know, basically. So I know the music was nothing to do with him. I can totally understand that he would want to be involved in every part of filming. And also, it's the first time I ever got involved in music was on that, you know. And it is tremendous when you go into the theatre and it's this great big orchestra, you know, and the maestro comes up and he taps his little thing, has a little nod, and they go in straight away to the most unbelievable music. You know, it's not, let's practice this, let's rehearse that. They've got the music in front of them. Conductor, you know, gets the orchestra together and they're off, you know. And it's I thought they'd be rehearsing. No, because they're all totally professional, you know, mostly session musicians. So they're used to doing it. It was, for me, a great experience, surrounded by all the, you know, I can't remember how many violins and cello, but you were kind of surrounded by this wall of music. So it was really exciting.
And they were running the film on the screens? I mean, obviously they were...
Oh, yes, yes, in sections, you know, but quite long sections, you know. Yeah. They can't look at the screen all the time, you know, but the screen is up there, which mostly is for the conductor. They're all fiddling away and elbowing their little cellos and kind of holding this great big group of people together. It was really a fantastic experience, you know.
Well, speaking of that, I'm very excited about this upcoming Superman in Concert, which we know has had to be delayed a number of times, but it's supposed to happen eventually at the Royal Albert Hall. So that should be tremendous.
I got tickets about 18 months ago. And then, of course, the whole world went wrong. And that would be a great experience. And I hope it is the Albert Hall, because something very special about the Albert Hall is it's just a wonderful place to hear music and in a kind of roundness of it, you know.
Peter, at family get-togethers, are you the one that has to take photos?
No, I didn't even have a camera for many years. I loved doing it at work, but I really didn't like taking photographs too much. I think I got a camera somewhere, but it's certainly not here with me in Normandy, you know. Madeline, my partner, she takes many more pictures than I do. And I think I can say that. I think she can hear me. And she's actually a better cameraman than I am. But I was complimenting you. Go away.
Yes. Do you have any particular memories of Bob Penn being around shooting all those fantastic photographs on the set?
Yes. I've known Bob on many films, you know. Bob's a very quiet man. And the other photographer, I think it's called Frank Connors, who's totally the opposite. So they work very well together, you know. There was a time in my early days when after every scene, you'd hand over to the stills man and he would do the whole thing with stills. But that seemed to have changed by then, and they got in amongst wherever they could to shoot it, obviously very often as close to where the camera was as possible. It always looked better that way, because when they set it up, it always had a kind of stillness about it, you know. So we're all mates in those days, you know, Bob and Frank. And very often you do four or five films together, you know.
Well, he shot a lot of photographs, and so did Frank. I think Douglas Luke was on the set too. And I've got so many of them, and I'm so happy that he did spend so much time. He ate through so many rolls of film. I can't even imagine how many.
No, it's great. I mean, it's there forever, then, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was always amazed by the following the film has, you know. And I remember, I was working on exteriors somewhere, And it's when we're doing Harry Potter, and I think we're on number 3 or number 4, and a lot of kids, really kind of East End of London, and, you know, the kids are quite cocky, you know. They come up, "Oh, were you on the film?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, why did it?" And they start questioning you about mistakes you made. And of course, I'm trying to remember, I think we're going to get a kind of nice compliment. And they say, "Well, you really screwed up there, because that didn't match. When he did this, he did that, you know." And I think, "Why'd you but it's amazing, you know, that the interest of film, and I got much more used to it now than I did in my early days, you know, when I thought it was basically a job, and I was very, very lucky to have that job, you know, because being a camera operator was the kind of joy of my life, you know. I was much more excited doing that than I ended up when I started directing. I much prefer when I was, well, of course, also a lot less responsibility when you're a camera operator. It was just a job I loved. And working when you have people like Donna and Bob Fosse, people like that, you work, John Borman, when you're working close to these great directors, it's just a privilege, you know.
I have to say, the first time I ever saw your name and Jeffrey Unsworth's name on the big screen was Zardoz.
Oh, yeah.
In college.
Okay, at least you weren't in infant school. Okay, wasn't that long? Well, John Borman is a force of nature. And Zardoz, I mean, none of us quite knew what we were going into, you know. I mean, we made it in Ireland, didn't have the money to do what John really needed to do and wanted to do, you know. Chris and his wife was doing the costumes, and then he ran out of money for costumes. So it ended up these Irish extras were coming in their white baggy Y-fronts, and she was spraying them with red paint. And then it started raining. quite revolting. But Chris was really, I mean, she was great, a real German lady. And "You stand still and I will spray you." you're covered in mud and peat. I say I'm lucky I did 2 or 3 other films with John, and I have huge, huge respect for him as a, not only as a man, but as a director.
Well, Peter, this has just been great today. I mean, it's always amazing to hear new insight, and even hearing you talk about, boy, John Williams scoring, and really excited that we found you, and we were able to ask you some of the questions we've always wanted to have the answers to.
I hope I did you proud.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it, because when you have people asking proper questions, it's so much easier. I've done a few interviews. Do you think, what the fuck? You know, because they ask, you know, almost like, "What's your favorite color?" type of thing. You're obviously a great enthusiast about filming, and that comes through in your questions, which is makes it easier. These are decades ago. You've got to get your memory back, you know.
We had a fantastic time, and thank you also to Madeline Most as well.
I will, yep.
Thank you so much.
My
pleasure.
Thank
you, Peter.
And there he is, the great Peter McDonald. Boy, Jim, great, great stories from Peter today, and what a memory. I mean, I think he said it in the end when he said, "Remember, you know, this was decades ago." And, you know, for us, it's always so fresh because it's our favorite film. But for him, he did a lot of things in between.
Wow, it's amazing, Jay. I was going back, rereading his American Cinematographer interview back in 79, all of his affection and admiration and respect for Dick Donner and Jeffrey Unsworth. And his filmography is just unbelievable. I mean, all of these movies that you and I have seen in the theater, or at least watched on home video, that he has been directly involved with, whether it was being a camera operator, a director of photography, a director. I mean, he was, the list is unbelievable. We're talking about Labyrinth, Batman, the first Michael Keaton film, the Rambo movies, holy cow, Excalibur, Zardoz. He even directed a film, a couple of war films, one of them Hamburger Hill. And it's just crazy. I can't believe how many films he's had a hand in. And my kids always talk about the Harry Potter film, The Goblet of Fire, as being their favorite.
Yeah.
He was second unit director. And how about The Empire Strikes Back? The Hoth planet scenes with the AT-ATs coming at you in the snow. That was Peter's work. Just incredible. Of course, Peter's work and Phil Tippett and everybody else who did the miniatures and stop motion. But what an amazing portfolio Peter has, and such a great guy. So humble and interested in reminiscing about all of this. What a great memory.
Yeah, it was great to have him. And very, very exciting to talk to anyone that had so much influence on a film. I mean, you think about those Krypton scenes we talked about. That is a unique look to that film that can't be duplicated. And a lot of that is obviously Jeffrey Unsworth, but boy, who knew that here's a guy that really had to get that all nailed down and worked out before they started filming those scenes with no hopes of fixing it in post-production. It had to be right.
Well, it did. And I remember going to see the movie and being blown away by the glow of those costumes. And of course I'm thinking, I've got to figure out how they did this.
Yeah.
I was always, especially as a teen, I'm thinking after the movie's over, I've got to see what I can find. How did they do it? And that's one of the challenges. I know that Warner Brothers, master colorists and scanning folks have had, the challenge has been, when we master the film, how do we handle those glowing costumes? We don't want to go overboard with making Brando's face too clear or make it too contrasty or whatever. We need to retain the look and feel of this film. And I know it's a challenging film because of diffusion filters and soft focus and backlighting and all of that sort of thing. Backlighting, an example would be when Jeff East and Glenn Ford are walking up the road talking to each other. That's a backlit shot. We don't want to ruin that look. They need to be a little bit in the shadow. And yeah, it's this in-camera stuff that you can't fix is very daring.
Well, we have plenty more ahead in 2021. As a matter of fact, on the next Cape Wonder Superman podcast, what is the job of a locations manager? Well, we are going to talk to one of them associated with the Superman films, and that's not all. Almost all of the Superman films he had a hand in, and we're excited to meet him and get to know him. So we'll keep him a little bit of a surprise for you, but that is on our next episode, Jim.
I can't wait, Jay. It's always exciting who we might bump into who's still out there and wants to talk about all of these fantastic films.
Well, Jim, as people know, the Cape to Wonder Superman podcast is all about preserving the legacy of Christopher Reeve and those great Superman films and everyone associated with them. So thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, exciting podcasts to come, and we hope to see you again soon. And as always,
stay super.
You've been listening to the Cape Wonder Superman podcast on the iHeartRadio app. Jay Towers is a Detroit TV anchor and morning radio host on 100.3 WNIC Detroit. Follow Jay on Instagram and Twitter at Jay Towers. Jim Bowers is the founder and editor of CapeWonder.com, the home of Cape Wonder Superman imagery. Follow Jim on Instagram at Cape Wonder and on Twitter at Cape Wonder Jim.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.